Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors, and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, author of Siege of Trebolin, and today's episode is something a bit different. I'm on a panel with a couple of other authors who have written for Choice of Games. And we're going to be talking about writing interactive fiction and kind of our different experiences with it. So first of all, Kate Hartfield, do you want to introduce yourself to the show?
Hi, I'm very happy to be here. I am a writer in Ottawa, Canada, and I write various things. I've had several books come out. My latest book is called The Embroidered Book, and I've got an Assassin's Creed novel about to come out. But I also write interactive fiction, and my 2 projects for Choice of Games came out in 2018 and 2019, 2 historical ones called The Road to Canterbury and The Magician's Workshop, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks, Kate. And yeah, for a bit of context, The Magician's Workshop was the first Choice of Games story that I ever played, and Kate was extremely useful back in the day when I was like, applying to write for Choice of Games. She like offered to look over my application for free, gave me so much advice, and really helped me get that book published. So thanks so much for that, Kate. It's good to have you back on now that I'm on the other side of that process. And yeah. Joining us is Hannah Powell-Smith. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here. So I'm a game writer and narrative designer. I've made 2 games with Choice of Games, one called Blood Money and one called Creme de la Creme. And I am currently working for a small indie game studio in the UK.
Awesome. And Hannah's been very modest there because Creme de la Creme is the highest rated game on the Choice of Games app. It's got like, I think, 3,000 more reviews than the nearest one. So Knows a thing or two when it comes to writing interactive fiction.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you.
So I think probably the first thing to kind of start us all off on this panel discussion is, what was your first experience getting into writing interactive fiction, and what drew you to start this off? Hannah, do you want to begin?
Sure. So my first experience was back when I was a teenager. I made some mods for Baldur's Gate 2 and got into the modding community there with my then girlfriend, now wife. And we made these NPC, like romanceable NPCs, for Baldur's Gate 2. And some of them were quite well received. And it's really crazy. Like, I went back and played, like looked on some of the forums like relatively recently, and people, like a couple of people, were still talking about it, and I was like, oh my god, this is like so long ago now. But that was really my first experience with it, and I kind of then went into went to university and did an English degree, and didn't really know how you wrote for games. I just didn't have any sense of it, neither did university. So I sort of set that aside for quite a while, and then got into making Twine games in the mid, like, kind of 2015 or so, making shortish Twine games, by that point I was quite familiar with choice of games selection, and then applied, once I'd made some of these Twine games, I applied to them, and kind of went from there, really.
Awesome. That's pretty sick. I had no idea about the Baldur's Gate mods. Are they still around? Like, can people still access them?
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, possibly. Somewhere on the internet.
What would someone Google to find it?
So the one that I liked, that we sort of like the most, is called Farren, F-A-R-E-N. He was a cool dude that was a partial, like, fighter thief. Like, he'd been a bit of an adventurer in his past, but then a lot of his companions died, and so he saw himself as a bit of a bad luck charm, and then could join up with the Baldur's Gate 2 crew.
Interesting. That is pretty cool. So what about you, Kate? Also, I've got your book here that I meant to put back on the shelf, so keep talking.
Yeah. For me, actually, Choice of Games was my first experience running interactive fiction. So I came to it from there, and just entirely as a prose writer. So it goes to show that you don't have to have any experience at all writing interactive fiction to write for Choice of Games. You know, it's a really interesting training ground, actually, and very supportive training ground, I found, as long as, you know, they're looking for people who do have storytelling skills and have writing skills, and are happy to help you along if you don't have this sort of technical skills to code and all the rest of it. And of course, they have their own language anyway. So it was a wonderful learning experience for me, having not written it before, and of course I've been a gamer my whole life and could remember the, you know, put book on table, turn left, turn right games of the early 80s, so it sort of called me back to that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think for me, the kind of first thing, my first experience with sort of interactive fiction was reading this short story by Garth Nix called Down to the Scum Quarter, I believe, which is like this 1980s kind of choose your own adventure style story that he wrote for a magazine. It was collected in a book with lots of his other short stories in it. And it's this really hilarious game where you're sort of this fantasy figure who's going through this medieval town trying to fulfill this very arbitrary objective. And it's just like really satirical and hilarious. And I was probably 14 or 15 at the time I read it, and I immediately thought, oh, I want to try to do something like that myself. So I wrote this very obvious copy of this called 00, The Affable Agent, which is sort of like a parody of James Bond, but if James Bond was like extremely incompetent. And you can still find it. It's actually out there on the internet. If you just search it in, you can find it somewhere. Not my finest work, but it's kind of interesting to see where we've gone from there. But I just really liked it. It was super fun, like, kicking the decisions to the reader. Because so often when you're writing, you're like, oh, what's the character going to do next? What's the character going to do next? Nowadays, that's like easy because I know my characters. But back when I was starting out as a younger writer, I was like, I don't know what they're going to do. So it was really satisfying to just like create an interesting situation. And then, you know, you just throw the agency and the choices to them. Yeah, so that was my experience with my first game. The reason why I have wanted to talk with you two in particular, and I mentioned, I'm not having my voice, and I mentioned this before the episode started, is that we all kind of are approaching Choice of Games from our own unique angles. Like, I've just had Siege of Trebling come out a few months ago. Hannah, you have, as I mentioned before, like the highest rated game on the platform. And Kate, like, some of your Choice of Games stories have been nominated for awards and like Nebula Awards, which is a pretty big deal. So I'd love to know, like, how did each of you kind of, first interact with Choice of Games, decide to write with them, and then more generally, what's your experience been like with writing for Choice of Games?
Yeah, I can jump in there. And apologies in advance if you hear a meow. Minerva has decided that she's going to join us today. So I've got a cat in my lap now.
Around in the background there.
Yeah, yeah. She will not be denied, you know. So, yeah. So for me, what happened with Choice of Games is that I had a few writer friends who had written for them. And so I had seen that people were writing for them and that, you know, they were happy to be writing for them and doing well. And I played their games and I really enjoyed playing them. And so I thought, okay, well, this is a really interesting and fun company. And I just really enjoyed what they were doing. So from there, they had a little thing on their website, which they still have, last I checked, that said, you know, we're looking for writers and here's how you apply. So the first step was to send in, I think your CV. And I thought, oh, well, you know, nothing will come of this, but I'll send my CV, you know, and then they'll reject me and that'll be, you know, job done. That's what I'll do. So I sent my CV and they didn't reject me. They said, well, you know, send us a pitch. So I said, okay, well, nothing will come of that, but I'll send a pitch. So I sent my pitches and they chose The Road to Canterbury. And lo and behold, after a few rounds of going over the outline and revising the outline, for me to understand how interactive fiction worked and to make sure that the story would work as interactive fiction, we were off to the races. So the first game was, the idea is that you are a pilgrim in Canterbury in the 14th century, and one of the other pilgrims in the inn is one Geoffrey Chaucer. So you are with him and with some other characters who may have inspired one of his works that he is about to write. And it's a time of sort of political upheaval and you can influence the politics of early 14th century England make some choices that way and change your own fate, of course. It was nominated for the very first Nebula in Game Writing. That was the first year that there was a Nebula in Game Writing, is what
the
I mean to say.
First and the best. It's all been downhill.
And it didn't win, but it was wonderful to be nominated, and it felt very historic and lovely to be down there in Los Angeles at the Nebula Award ceremony. And I was nominated for something else the same year in prose, so it was a very
up with the award shows.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, sorry, I can't stay at the Oscars after party. I've got another award show to go to.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It was very cool, and it was very, you know, everyone had this sense that the Game Award was important and wonderful, and it was very supportive among all the nominated game writers as well. That, you know, this is wonderful to be here at last. And so that was just, it was all good. I have a very wonderful experience. And I'll stop rambling, but then I had a second game called The Magician's Workshop, which is set in Renaissance Florence the following year. And that was also nominated for the Nebula Award. So, exactly. So that was a virtual ceremony. So it wasn't as fun, but, and again, it didn't win, but again, totally fine. So those are my two games.
That's pretty awesome. Hannah, what about your games?
Yeah, so I, like I said before, I'd been making some Twine games before kind of applying to Choice of Games, and sort of similar to Kate, I didn't really have much of a sense of like, oh, someone would pay for this, but a interactive fiction magazine that's now it's now not going anymore, but you can still get it online, which is called Sub-Q magazine, contacted me about a game that I'd put up for free, and they said, oh, do you like, we'd be interested in reprinting this. And I was sort of like, what, like, wow. how is this happening? And that sort of that really kind of built my confidence and made me go, okay, well, maybe I can do this. And I'd admired and enjoyed playing Choice of Games for a long time, actually. Like, I think the first one I played was the Choice of Romance that's now called Affairs of the Court. That was the first, like one of the first games that they created. I must have played it like back in the 2012-ish time, like years and years ago. And I'd sort of been keeping up with them and really enjoyed them. And then a couple of people that I knew had, they were sort of at the pitching and outlining stage with them. And so I was like, oh yeah, maybe like if they're doing it, then like maybe I can give it a go. And so I pitched Blood Money to them, which is a fantasy game set in a sort of like vaguely Venetian-esque spooky city with lots of ghosts. You play a character that can use their blood to summon and control ghosts, and you're part of a crime family that are sort of trying to get power with their rivals and kind of deal with city politics and kind of people scrambling for power, basically. And that came out in 2018. And then I pitched Creme de la Creme, which is really different. It's still fantasy, but it's not got supernatural elements, really. Like there's some people are kind of a bit spiritualist, and some of them believe in ghosts and fortune telling and that sort of thing, but it's not there's not as much sort of overt kind of fantasy spookiness in there, and it's also almost like there's some violence in it, but there's not in the same way. Like in Blood Money, you can murder a bunch of people, you can like turn [S2] Nice. [S1] On your family and have them killed and all this sort of thing. I wanted to sort of try doing a game which wasn't sort of relying on that, and kind of have a lot of stakes and tension that were much more social, and kind of it's a school story where you're at a fancy boarding school trying to repair your family's reputation because they've been scandaled, and you're trying to maybe get to university or make a good marriage and that sort of thing. And it's got a slightly sort of Edwardian 1920s sort of like vague feel, but it's not a specific historical period, it's a fantasy. And that was really interesting, sort of making these, like building up these social situations that felt high stress, without necessarily being very violent. And like, there's a bit where you can, if you want to, you can throw a paperweight at someone pivotal moment. And I wanted to make that feel really kind of shocking, because it's very like, oh, like no one would ever do that in this sort of environment.
Highly improbable.
And so that was fun, kind of including that kind of scene.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I first stumbled across Choice of Games in 2016, I think it was. And at the time I was studying architecture at uni and hadn't published anything. Had only really, I don't think I'd even published any short stories at that stage. And I was like, wow, this is cool that they are just accepting people off the street to write for them. I wonder if one day that would be a possibility. But I didn't really have any publications to my name, so I thought, oh, I'm just going to forget about this, maybe come back to it in a few years. And then it would have been at the start of, I think, 2020, when I just suddenly remembered them. At that time, I just published my first book, Fires of the Dead, which is this one just here, back in September of 2019. And I was about to publish Across the Broken Stars, which I don't think you two can see, but our viewers will be able to see it when it's on YouTube afterwards, which is this one over here. And I thought, Remember that Choice of Games thing and how you were keen to write for that. You might actually like have a crack at this now, because you've got a few books out there and, you know, you probably have the skill to potentially pull it off. But I still thought this is such a long shot. So I had never actually played any of their games up until that stage. And so that's when I cracked open the Magician's Workshop and, you know, started playing that. And I was like, look, I might not enjoy this at all. I might find this like totally different to what I was expecting it. And then I probably won't write for it if that's the case. But fortunately, I picked a really good game to start off with because I loved it. And I was like, oh, this is sick. I would love to create something like this. Just a few years before that, I'd gone to Florence as well. And that game is set in Florence. So it really felt like so immersive and so entertaining and truly like nothing else I had ever experienced. Like played a couple of video games when I was a kid, not a massive video game player these days. And this was just something different where it like took everything that was great about novels, like all that imagination, all that ability to kind of put yourself in the story, and then merged it with this freedom to like explore the pathways that you're most interested in. And I love that game heaps. I played another one, Sword of the Slayer as well, which was fantastic. And I thought, wow, okay, this is actually really cool. I wonder if I can interview the authors of these games to like try to get their hints for writing for Choice of Games so that I can, you know, hopefully not make any mistakes when I'm applying to it. And both Kate and Stephen S. Andrew Swan, who wrote Sword of the Slayer, were really gracious with their time, came on an earlier podcast I had. I don't know. Yeah, you came on the Novel Analyst podcast. Is that right? I think it was a few years ago. Was it this one?
It's very possible.
You did come on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Time is a blur now.
Yeah, it was years back because it was like start of 2020. Yeah, and I talked to you, Kate, talked to S. Andrew Swan, and just got a lot of like good advice from both of you. So I thought, okay, I'm actually going to apply for this thing. I probably have like zero chance. So I sent through my CV and then just like instantly assumed that I didn't get it. Because that's always usually been the safest attitude when it comes to applying for writing stuff, is just assume it's not going to happen. And then that way you don't get disappointed. And I totally forgot about it for like a month. And then I got an email back from them saying, oh, great. Now send, you know, your next phase, which would be the pitches or whatever. And at every single phase, much like yourself, Kate, like I thought, okay, this is it. This is the time when they realize I've got no talent and that I'm a hack and that I can't do this. And they say, like, stop, you know, polluting our inbox with your trash. But fortunately, they haven't realized that yet. So managed to get all the way through to publishing Siege of Treblin a few months ago. And yeah, that's been great. It's been like, out of everything that I've published so far, it's definitely been the most successful in terms of sales, which is sick. And yeah, it was really fun writing it, even though it was 2 years to write, which is so much longer than everything else I've worked on. So yeah, I guess bridging off that, we can maybe do a round talking about like what advice would we give for authors who are out there and they're interested in writing for Choice of Games. What would be your best advice for, you know, someone who's maybe written a couple of things before and they really want to try this? They're maybe a fan of playing the games. Hannah, do you want to perhaps start us off?
Yeah, so I think what I would say is play lots of games, and like play a variety of Choice of Games games, and see what you like and what you don't like, and kind of figure out where you like what decisions you might have made if you were making it, and that can really give you a sense of the possibilities, because there's a lot of variety between all the different games. Like, they're so different, even just like the style of writing, the like the way that the stats are used, and like just the even just the genre. It makes such a big difference, and yeah, like everyone is so different, and there's so many possibilities. So I'd say see what works for you and what you might want to do differently. And also when it gets to the point where you're thinking about ideas of plots and or like settings or whatever, kind of think always about the player, and sort of what players might want to explore, where how you want to kind of shape their experience, because there's always going to be the possibility where like you can't make it a complete sandbox. Basically, you can't sort of allow them to do everything. So how are you going to kind of shape what the possibilities are that they can do and give them as much as you're willing to, in terms of like what where they might want to go, how they might want to interact? Like, don't make assumptions about oh, like no one will want to do this, because inevitably, like if you the minute you're like, yes, oh, why would anyone want to do that? Like immediately, like everyone will want to.
100%. Yeah, and in particular, the games that you have to play so that you can fully appreciate the majesty of this genre is Siege of Treblin, Creme de la Creme, Blood Money, The Road to Canterbury, and The Magician's Workshop. If you don't play all of those games, then you'll never truly learn to master this art. Kate, what about you? What advice would you give to an author who wants to apply to work for Choice of Games? So I guess just, you know, whatever advice you gave me tended to work out all right. So
I can't remember now. Yeah, I agree with everything that Hannah said, of course. And I think one of the things I found is that it was really helpful to be a little bit flexible in terms of your idea. I think if you come to them with something completely fully formed and, you know, like, this is the idea I'm writing and nothing else, you know, that might work, but it's probably better to, you know, usually you have to have three pitches or four, and they might choose the idea that you were not expecting them to. So be a little bit flexible in terms of what ideas you have. You know, as Hannah was talking about, not every idea is going to work for Choice of Games conceived in certain ways, because just the way that their games are structured, you have to have certain scope and certain kinds of choices and that kind of thing. So it's possible that you may need to kind of tailor your approach in a way that you wouldn't if you were using the same idea to create a novel, for example, or a film. It's just going to be a little bit different. So I think for me, especially as a beginning Choice of Games writer, it helped to come into it with a little bit of humility and say, look, this is my cool idea, but be open to the fact that they're going to say, that's great, but be careful here, you know, make sure that you tweak it here and that kind of thing. It is a very collaborative process.
Yeah, and I think on the note of like when you're pitching ideas to them, yeah, like sometimes they will definitely go with the one you're not expecting. And that kind of happened to me. Like Siege of Trevelin was, out of the four pitches that I sent through, it was the one that was the quickest for me to write. I was like, oh yeah, fantasy siege story. Haven't written that before. That'll be kind of cool. Like nailed off the, you know, the little pitch for it in probably 20 minutes or something. Some of my other pitches, I labored over those for days and I was like so complicated with them. And I was like, oh, this is going to be mind blowing. This is going to be so cool. And then like they didn't go for it. And initially I was like, oh, kind of wanted to write that other thing. But in hindsight, like I am so glad that they picked this one, because those other stories, now that I look back on them, they just would have been so much more difficult and probably way less entertaining to write. Whereas this, it's like, I love writing fantasy. You can just do so much with a siege story. And yeah, they definitely made the right call. I think the other thing that's worthwhile is like the reason I think I was able to kind of get in my foot in the door with them is because of previous published work. And like, I think Kate, you were saying at the start of the episode, like you don't have to just write games in order to be in with a chance of this. If you've self-published a novel and it's done like decently well and it's got good reviews, then that can be a great foot in the door. And yeah, even, you know, short stories and stuff could potentially be the way in. But yeah, from my experience, definitely having the two novels published previously and also having a bit of an audience through like my podcast and my email list at that time was useful, because it meant it's kind of a sign of your credibility going into it. So if we all fast rewind rather back to our first Choice of Games story that we wrote, what mistakes did we make that we would advise authors to try to avoid in the future? I can think of a ton of for me personally. Kate, do you want to start us off on this one?
Sure. Gosh, so many. I mean, I think it's probably, if not a universal Choice of Games experience, then certainly a common Choice of Games experience, to struggle just with the amount of work, right? And with deadlines and with putting it all together and with the length of the project, because it's difficult, especially as a beginning Choice of Games writer, to really get a sense of how many words you're going to have to create to do what you set out to do in your outline. So yeah, I mean, there may be some writers who just had no issues with that at all, but it certainly was something that I struggled with, and I know some other writers have struggled with a little bit as well. It's just that, especially if you're not coming from interactive fiction, if you're coming from linear prose, getting used to the idea that every interaction is going to have at least three variations to some degree, and what that is going to do to your process as a writer. And especially if you come from it as a reviser, you know, like I am a heavy reviser of prose, but with Choice of Games, you can't do that so much, because you can't, if you go and make structural revisions, you know, you will never ever be done. So outlining is really important in choice of games, even if you're not an outliner in other kinds of prose. You know, just get used to it. And you can revise, but you have to just make peace with the fact that it's better not to have to rewrite it several times because it's going to be this long project. You know, mine is not super long by choice of game standards. I think they're both about 180,000 words. And on any given playthrough, I think, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 words. So, but for me, it was just sort of balancing the workload and understanding what that would look like.
What about you, Hannah? What were the kind of mistakes that you made on the first game that you would advise other authors to steer clear of?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Kate with sort of just the sheer amount of content that you generate. Like I sort of had a sense of how long some of the longer games were when I first started Blood Money, but I didn't foresee that I would be ending up like getting towards that, and it just ended up being so much larger than I expected. Like one of the later chapters just was huge. But I would say when you're doing such a kind of large-scale interactive work, it can be quite challenging figuring out the pacing. And so because you're writing kind of chunks of the story, and you might not have so much of a sense of kind of the big picture of like kind of how it feels to play through this, like the whole thing. And it's impossible to play through every path anyway, because it's so large. So I think with Blood Money, I had that, like that was definitely a learning curve kind of some pathways had more foreshadowing about what the kind of final confrontations and challenges were going to be, but others there wasn't so much depending on what you'd done. So I felt like some of the issues that come up towards the end kind of come out of nowhere a bit if you haven't done particular things before. And like it's a kind of it can be fun to be surprised, but at the same time it was quite a challenge to kind of like balance that. And I think I managed to sort of do that better, I think, in Creme de la Creme, but I don't think it's not something that I've like fully found the cure for yet. But also with Blood Money, I had a character that appears in chapter 2 where they turned out that they were a member of the police that was trying to infiltrate your family's crime stuff, and you could murder them and just dump them in the river, and that's fine, but then I like they if you don't do that, they're quite a major character. So then I was sort of in a position where I was like, oh, I've got to make up another like an alternative character to kind of have this role, or have an alternative scenes that or pathways that happen if this person isn't around, which was interesting, but at the same time I don't think I would do that the same way another time.
Sure, yeah, I definitely relate to like the struggles that come as soon as you can have a major character that dies, because like, yeah, there's points throughout Siege of Trevelin where like some of the major non-player characters can die. And I thought, oh yeah, that'll be pretty easy to, you know, build the coding in for that. It makes it such a pain. Cause like, yeah, there was even one bug actually that got through to the final game that I had to patch after it released, where I think it was Priestess Sephira can like die in the final battle, and then she was officiating your wedding if you married a different character at the end. And yeah, that was embarrassing to try to have to patch that back up again. Yeah, so that's definitely a mistake I wish I could avoid. I think another one as well, and that sort of relates to this point but on a broader level, is like be really aware of the knock-on effects of small decisions early on. Like even something as simple as having, you know, 6 stats in your game instead of 5 stats can make it really, really additionally complex on top of that. Because now you're having to like, you know, make sure that all of these different stats are balanced, make sure that every choice is kind of like, you know, matching on them evenly. And I actually took one out of Siege of Trevelin because we reached a point at the end where my editor, Abby, was like, oh, it just feels like these two different stats you have here are sort of the same thing. And, you know, it kind of feels like then neither one really gets a chance to shine or neither one really gets a chance to get strong. So I went through and condensed them all back into one stat and it made it much better, much more streamlined. Yeah, so definitely be aware of like the impact that these little decisions can have early on. A classic example of this would be like, oh, you decide to branch the story so that the main character can travel to one character, to one place or a different place. And that sounds kind of simple, but that can almost double the effort that you need to do. And if you do that across a big story, then that can add up quite substantially. I definitely relate as well to the fact of the story just ballooning far larger than you're expecting. Because I was initially gunning for 200,000 words for the game, which was still staggeringly big to me. My previously longest novel up until that point was like 80,000 words. So 200,000, I thought, oh yeah, there'll be plenty to cover this. And ended up coming at 280,000, which is insane, like compared to the previous stuff that I've written. And it's like not the scope of what you've written, Hannah, but like, yeah, that felt mind-blowing to me. So yeah, just be aware that it's probably going to expand to be a lot bigger than you think. And then probably the other bit of advice I wish I'd given my former self is don't add complexity just for the sake of complexity. And an example of this is there's one scene where you're at a party and you can go and play a gambling game. And the first time I wrote that game, I spent 3 weeks developing like a poker mechanic inside my code, where you would literally be able to play like as many rounds as you want up until a total of 30. You would be able to bet a different amount for each round. You would get a random number of cards each round. All other three characters at the table would get a random number of cards each round as well. And it just was a nightmare because when you would try to bug test it, the software would run through all these iterations and it wouldn't have enough iterations to like get through all of the possible scenarios for this. So things would just keep breaking. And I sent it into my editor and she was just like, you do realize players will have like very little difference with their experience if you just use the standard way of checking stats to create, you know, this game. And I realized, oh yeah, like it's still going to be pretty much the same experience if it just works the same way that everything else works in this game, but it won't be as complicated. So that was like 3 weeks of wasted effort down the gutter. but that's still floating around there somewhere in my hard drive. So maybe I'll release that someday, my standalone poker mechanic. So yeah, that'll probably
I have two different games of chance.
Yeah, pretty much.
I did the games of chance as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you actually code them with chance or did you?
I did. Oh. Yeah.
Oh my word.
And they let you do that. That's crazy. Maybe like they did, saw your code and then they're like, Jed, you can't do it.
That's
wild.
Yeah. There's a dice game, like there's the game of hazards, like a medieval dice game in The Road to Canterbury, and then there's a card game in The Magician's Workshop. And I can't remember, I seem to recall the card game not being super complicated, but there is a random, you know, there's a random card generator, and then I had to code like for every card that you would get, this is the hand that you would have or whatever. And
yeah,
I had so much fun with those, but it is not something I'd recommend to others for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super fun, but I think it ultimately does come back down to like reminding yourself, you know, put yourself in the player's shoes. Is this going to make a better experience for the player or not? And like, it probably maybe makes it 5% better if it is a truly random experience and it's really replayable. But like, is the 3 weeks that you spend on that worthwhile? Or could you have written like a whole other chapter of amazing story that the players would probably appreciate a lot more in that time? And the answer is probably the second one. But having said that, if I do write another one, I might try to sneak in some some cheeky random stuff there.
Do it. Yeah.
I'll send you my code.
I'd love to have a look at that actually.
Yeah.
Speaking of second games, I've only written one game, but I think I'd probably like to write one in the future because I really enjoyed this process and there's already a few ideas percolating around there. So I'd be really curious to know for both of you, what was the experience like going from your first game to the second? Like, were there any things that were significantly easier? Were there any things that you had decided that you were going to do differently? Do you want to maybe start off, Kate?
Sure. Yeah. So for me, Certainly some things were easier, you know, like I understood the mechanics a lot better and I understood just writing interactive fiction a lot better and all the things that we've been talking about. a lot of things were changing on the technical side between my first game and my second game. So I actually wrote the second game in Seaside, which is like a platform for choice of games, whereas I wrote the first one in just a very plain text editor. And there were some mechanical things in ChoiceScript that had changed significantly. You know, like I don't think we had multi-replace in the first game, for example.
Oh, really?
Which will mean nothing to some people. But yeah, there was no multi-replace. So there were things that were quite significant changes to how we write in ChoiceScript that I had to learn for the second game that I didn't do in the first game. So I did feel like there were some new challenges and, you know, for both games, one of the things I really like about writing in ChoiceScript is that there's a fantastic wiki with all this information. Choice of Games puts a lot. Oh, it's so great. And, you know, on the Choice of Games website, there's a lot of information all the time about the evolving language and different hacks. And there are also just a whole bunch of blogs and writers do share information. You know, like Jed and I were just laughing about sharing code, but, you know, we do sort of, you know, bug each other and say, oh, I don't know how to do this. How did you do it? And you can read the code of games. You can go and look under the hood. So that's really helpful. And I found that with both games that I did all of that a lot.
Awesome. What about you, Hannah?
Yeah, I was in the same boat with the multi-replace and things. Like basically when I did Blood Money, it was just before some developments happened to the code. And so then I think I ended up like doing some, like when I was doing final edits, I like incorporated some of it. But then with Creme de la Creme, like that was I was fully on board with that, and so it made it a lot easier. But I think some of it was I was like I was saying before, like I wanted to sort of challenge myself and have a game that wasn't as violent or kind of it wasn't as action-y, but still have high stakes for my second game. And I really enjoyed sort of being like, right, I'm gonna make this very like really like relatively non-action-y, but make like try and make the player feel really tense about things. I wanted to have more emphasis on romance in it, because I do have, like, I've got romanceable characters in Blood Money, but it wasn't as much of an emphasis. And then I just went really wild and was like, I'll have 10 love interests. And this would be great and really manageable. And like, don't do that. That's really silly.
Not going to stress me out at all.
for my third game, I've whittled it down again. So that was wanting to have a bigger cast of characters, which was fine, but like not recommended really. And yeah, I think it was interesting, like sort of my life looked different at that point as well, because while I was writing at least like the first like two thirds of Blood Money or so, I was also working an office job, and then ended up losing that job. And so I was full time like doing freelance like writing. So for Creme de la Creme, like I did have a lot more time devoted to it, so like I was able to sort of like focus on it a lot more, and I think that's part of why it's so large. because I sort of had a bit more freedom to do that rather than trying to squeeze it around like evenings and weekends sort of thing.
Yeah, I got a few like follow-up things I'd love to know about Creme de la Creme as well, because as we've mentioned before, like it went gangbusters compared to Blood Money, which still I would think is a very successful game in terms of sales and everything. But like Creme de la Creme, it was like, you know, on another level compared to it. And why do you think that players responded so much more strongly to it?
Gosh, it's really interesting. I wonder whether it's because it was an easier concept to grasp. Like it's quite, like I guess it's in a genre which is quite easily easily understandable. Like, it's like it's a boarding school story, and it's and like it's sort of yeah, you've got a kind of immediate kind of reference point for it, I think. And I think as well, I think the kind of the emphasis on the romance and the kind of social interactions is something that people have said that they really enjoyed. And it was interesting sort of trying out doing romanceable characters that could be different genders as well, which I hadn't done before, other than in a short game that I wrote in Blood Money. Like, everyone is a fixed gender, and then so for Creme de la Creme, like I mostly did it kind of swapped out of a kind of like wanting to challenge myself, because I've been like, oh, I wouldn't be able to do that. It would be too difficult. And then I was like, wait, no, I'll try and do it. But I think that sort of, yeah, it's interesting. Like, I was going to say, like, often people enjoyed being able to tailor their romance experience a bit more. But on the other hand, some people don't like it. So it's kind of, it could be one or the other. But yeah, it was interesting. Actually, I asked when I was then pitching something afterwards, I asked Abby, my editor, sort of, oh, why did you choose that out of the other pitches? And she said that they wanted to they wanted to try something different, because it was something that hadn't really been done before in the Choice of Games line. So I think, like, maybe it was kind of the right place at the right time, kind of. People were like, oh, this is something that's a bit different, and like enjoyed it. But yeah, it was really fun to write. When I read the code again, I always it looks really arcane to me, and I'm like, why did I do that in that like weirdly complicated way? But yeah, like, I think I worked hard on kind of trying to make the scenes feel really distinct to each other, and kind of make all the characters feel different and distinct, I think.
I think that's really cool that you've pointed out that they were looking for something different. And, like, you know, normally when you're looking for something different and you publish something that's outside of your bread and butter, it doesn't do that great. But, like,
yeah.
This just shows that you have the opportunity to, like, still, you know, be finding new angles to this. And we are still in a very early phase of Choice of Games stories, in a sense. Like, they've published, what, maybe 100 and 120 or games or so. Like, that still leaves a lot of room for, you know, discovering the next kind of, the next thing that readers don't know they want, that they want. So, yeah, hopefully that'll inspire some people out there who are maybe thinking about writing that stuff now.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that it, yeah, that's a really good point, because I think if I had been thinking, oh, I want to do something that's more like Blood Money, then I might not have enjoyed it as much, because I'd sort of feel like, oh, I'm going to do something that's more dark and moody and fantastical, which is also awesome, and was sort of more the kind of thing that I was doing at that point in general. And yeah, it was nice to sort of stretch myself and be like, oh, I'll try this other thing.
Nice.
Yeah, right. And another option for people too. Oh, sorry. Yeah, another option that people have is to write in choice scripts, but not for Choice of Games as well. So you can, you know, you can use the language to make your own projects and play around if you don't want to do something that fits into what Choice of Games is doing. And they also have hosted games, which is games that don't quite fit what they're doing, but they'll put them on their platform and give them some support and that kind of thing as well. So there are a lot of different options.
Awesome. All right. So kind of the last question before we wrap this sort of thing up, what would you say is your number one bit of advice for anybody who's writing an interactive fiction game? It's like, if there's just only one thing that you could kind of suggest to them, what would it be? Who wants to start off? And I'll make you two go first so that I have time to think of my answer.
Well, actually, I want to sort of piggyback on something that you said, Jed. So
that's where I'm going to
take one. Because when you were talking about, you know, like the like putting overcomplicated randomness in and that sort of thing. I think, you know, there's a really good point to that, which is that thinking about the player experience and realizing that, okay, the player is not going to know how clever my code was here. If I just do this other thing, their experience is the same, you know. But I think in general, that principle of how is the player experiencing this and thinking that all of the time, no matter what you're doing, is just something to always keep in mind. And sometimes it just means that you add in an extra sentence and you think, okay, this would really enhance the player experience. It can be a very small thing that just makes them feel like this is a distinct choice and a distinct pathway. And it didn't take a lot of work for you to do that, but it just changes everything, the flavor in some way. So just always putting yourself in
something like that. Yeah, those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it makes them feel like, okay, this is a coherent experience that I'm having. So just putting yourself in their shoes all the time is my biggest advice.
That's really good. Yeah, totally agree with that. Anna, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with that as well. it's really cool, like when you're playing and you really feel like the game's listening to you, even if it's not necessarily like this choice led to a particular different, like completely different storyline. Like if the game is sort of paying attention to you, then it's just a really nice feeling as a player. I think something that I would think about. My advice is something that I didn't really do with Blood Money and then I did more with Creme de la Creme, is thinking about what themes in the game are like the kind of the story and the like also the setting and the plot that you want to do, and thinking about how you want it to interact with your stats. Because the kind of game mechanics and your themes can be really, like, they can say a lot about each other in a way that is unique to interactive fiction. And that's something like really powerful that you can use in a way that you can't with a book, say. And I'm thinking about it, like one of the things that struck me with the Magician's Workshop was like the faith and humanism stat, and like when I was looking at the stats before I'd even started playing the game, I was like, oh this is really interesting, like this is telling me that this game is going to have like kind of thoughts about divinity, and like that makes sense because the historical setting, and there's going to be questions about the kind of philosophy and like what, like how people are feeling about the church. Oh, this is really interesting. And like it kind of it says something before you even start playing. And similarly with the Siege of Treblane, like looking at all of the stats, you're like, okay, this is going to be something that is quite strategic. You've got a sense of like where the kind of stats of your of the strength of the city in different ways. Like it's almost like you feel tense, you feel stressed out, like looking at it straight away. You're like, oh no, how am I gonna sort out my walls? They're gonna get crumbled, aren't they? Like and I think that's something that is it can sort of shape the player's experience even before they start. And that can be just something that also helps you when you're kind of figuring out outlining or kind of figuring out what you want your story to be.
I think that's huge because, yeah, like when you're playing through this story, you have no idea what pathway the players are going to take. So creating that sense of cohesion and weaving a theme throughout it can be tricky. And that's why thinking about your theme with how it relates to your stats is so critical, because that is your thing that is constantly referred to throughout the story and is really shaping the player's experience and what they're focusing on. So yeah, that is really vital for creating that sense of cohesion and kind of thematic complexity to the game. I think my probably best bit of advice for it would be, for every scene and for every decision, if you can, ask yourself, why is this going to be one player's favorite scene or favorite decision? Because it's really easy to have your set pathway that you're super excited about going down, and you're like, oh, I want all players to go down this pathway because it's my favorite. But I think you have to, and this was something that I really had to learn and really enjoyed once I learned it, you have to realize, okay, there's four different characters that the main character might choose to hang out with. For me personally, I probably have a favorite, but for players, like each one of them is going to choose a different favorite. So I've got to make sure that whenever I'm writing all of those different interludes, I give them a reason why this could be their favorite scene in the whole experience. And that's a really good guiding light because, yeah, it just makes you excited to write every single thing. Like, it just takes away, you know, telling yourself, oh, I've got to write this scene for this side bit that I'm not interested in. Suddenly, when you're asking, why is this going to be someone's favorite? You go, okay, like, maybe this is a scene that I could approach it in a pretty boring and just, like, you know, feel paint by the numbers fashion, or I could, like, actually make this really interesting, even though it isn't the core of my game. So, yeah, I think that was really useful for me to kind of shape it. And same goes for books as well. Like, I try to ask that, you know, in every chapter. Why is this going to be someone's favorite chapter, even if it's not the big climax or the big reveal or the big twist or something like that? Awesome. All right. So as we conclude this one, maybe we can talk about what we are currently writing and what will be like our next release. So Kate, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So my next release is a book called Assassin's Creed, The Megas Conspiracy. And it's my first video game tie-in novel. So it brings my two worlds together. Yeah. So that was really fun. It's coming out from Aconite Books, you know, which publishes for the Ubisoft game. In August, and it is set in the 19th century and in the Assassin's Creed universe, and you get to meet Ada Lovelace and have all kinds of adventures. I say you as if it's interactive fiction. It's not.
The interaction they have with it is they decide whether to turn the page or whether to
Exactly. Do you turn the page or do you not? So that's lots of fun. So that's coming out very soon. After that, I've got a couple of other books that are not yet announced. So stay tuned for some possible announcements is all I can say at the moment. But there are books coming down the road. And the embroidered book, my latest novel, just came out quite recently. So that's still in stores. And Jed's got it there on the shelf. That's a historical fantasy novel. Yes, lovely. Thanks. And you can find me on the internet. I'm easy to find, Kate Hartfield, everywhere.
Awesome. What about you, Hannah? And yeah, feel free to plug like your socials as well at the end of it. I should have said that.
Yeah, so the next game I've got coming out is a Choice of Games game, which is more of a novella length than a novel, like interactive novel length. It's called Noblesse Oblige, and it's about... the main character is going to a foreign island to teach an aristocrat their language, or like help tutor them in it. And it's very like really remote kind of crumbling mansion. There's a load of threatening auras of everywhere. It's a lot more moody, and there's more kind of violence in it. It's set in the same world as Creme de la Creme, but you're kind of out of the like genteel boarding school sort of setting, and in this like kind of very unfamiliar environment. There's a lot of romance in it. I was inspired a lot by Jane Eyre when I was when I was writing it, and which was a lot of fun. And so that's going to come out. I'm not sure entirely when. It's in copy edit at the moment, so it shouldn't be too long. And I'm also writing another game that's set in the Creme de la Creme setting, which is, again, it's in the setting, but it's with a different main character, where you are at you're at boarding school, but you're one of the royal family, and are kind of navigating a lot of political upheaval with people doing campaigning about suffrage rights, which are currently in the game are immensely like not really rights at all, and people are wanting more rights, funny that. And you can sort of decide how you want to interact with that or not if you don't want to, and have lots of fun at boarding school as well. So that's in progress. I'm about three quarters of the way through writing it at the moment. So I'm hoping that it will come out sometime this year. If it doesn't, it will be early next year. That's been interesting because it's very related to Creme de la Creme. You are at the rival boarding school that does appear in in the first one. Some characters reappear a few years older, and that sort of thing. And in my day job, I'm working on an unannounced game with Tributary Games, which are an indie studio. And that's very exciting.
Is that interactive, or is that a traditional video game sort of thing?
It's a multiplayer social narrative game. I can't really say any more than that, but it's very cool.
That's pretty cool.
I'm H. Powell Smith on Twitter.
Fantastic. All right, I'll try to put links to all that stuff in the show notes below. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been really, really fun. It's super cool to talk Choice of Games stuff with other Choice of Games authors now that I'm on the other side of actually publishing it. So thank you both for joining me. And thank you for listening or watching, and we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
As we end this episode, I wanted to give a big shout out to all our patrons who help support the show, and an extra special shout out to our legendary wizard patrons, Taylan and Daniel. If you want to help support the show and get access to a huge library of exclusive patron-only episodes, go to patreon.com/wizardswarriorswords. You can find the link in the show notes below.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.